This is The Takeaway for Thursday, February 9th, 2017.
I don't ever want to call a court biased, so I won't call it biased. And we haven't had a decision yet. But courts seem to be so political.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And next to the media, it seems judges are pretty high up there on the Donald Trump it list.
And it would be so great for our justice system if they would be able to read a statement and do what's right. And that has to do with the security of our country, which is so important.
The Trump executive order is now before a three-judge panel at the Ninth Circuit. The president has called the hearing of this case disgraceful and said a bad high school student would do a better job than the judges in this case. Trump's Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch then told the senior senator from Connecticut that such remarks were, quote, demoralizing and disheartening. But humanitarian agencies are the ones really scrambling in response to this order. The International Rescue Committee is one of the largest global humanitarian relief and refugee resettlement organizations, and David Miliband is the IRC's president. From where he sits, the U.S. is letting its reputation as a global sanctuary go up in flames. And that reputation, he says, will be tarnished for years to come.
Our focus is on the chaos and the confusion that's been caused for legitimate refugees who've been through the U.S. security vetting system, which takes 18 to 24 months, and have now been stuck, first of all, in limbo, and now with an opportunity to come into the U.S., given the reversal of the executive order. So we're very concerned that, given that for decades America has been a real beacon in the way it's treated refugees, for that to become a thing of the past would be worse than a tragedy.
Focusing on the United States, what has changed and in what cities have you had the most problem?
Well, the IRC works coast to coast and between the coasts. So we're in big cities like New York and LA, but we're also in Boise, Idaho and Wichita, Kansas. The biggest change, obviously, is that we were expecting the week before last to have about 50 or 60 refugees a day arriving. And then the executive order was published on the 27th and of January. And suddenly the people who were at the airports or had booked their plane tickets had no permission to come, even if they had proper visas and proper refugee clearance. So our immediate concern was with their status at airports and in countries around the world. And many of them had sold up everything that they'd ever had ready to move their families. So we had to support them out there. In the US, we obviously had deep concern among those with family members. And so a lot of our staff had to spend time reaching out to refugees who we had resettled but were separated from the rest of their families. And some of the stories are truly tragic, of kids not being able to join their parents, of wives not being able to join their husbands. And it has been a roller coaster because obviously the decision of the Seattle court to lift the ban on refugees arriving, the indefinite ban on refugees from Syria, the 120-day ban on refugees from the seven named countries, has given us the chance to get some of that family reunification done and to get some more people into the country in line with the law.
The president's rationale in enacting this executive order is to make more stringent the vetting process for refugees and for people coming into the United States. Do you have any sense that the vetting that had already been done for the people that you are responsible for was inadequate in any way?
No, we don't. I mean, in fact, we know that it's harder to get to the U.S. as a refugee than by any other route. 12 to 15 different government agencies, including the CIA, do in-person interviews. They do biometric testing to make sure that people are who they say they are. And we also know that refugees have fled from hell. That's why they want to make it to the U.S. They've come from war zones in Syria or Afghanistan or Somalia. And so while it's entirely appropriate for a new administration to review any vetting system, we can say with confidence that successive Homeland Security secretaries from the Bush administration and from the Obama administration have testified to the soundness of the existing system. And that's why we say the way out of this legal chaos, the way out of the humanitarian morass, the way out of, frankly, the reputational harm that's being done to the United States by the propaganda gift that's being given to extremists to say that the US doesn't want Muslims to come to the country. The way out of those problems is for the administration to conduct its review, which is perfectly legitimate for them to do so, but to leave existing arrangements, existing sound arrangements in place while they talk to the real professionals in the Department of Homeland Security and elsewhere about whether there are any improvements that can be made.
But what do you say that if you stack up reputational problems and chaos and administrative difficulties and even the inconvenience of individuals who are trying to make it into the United States, compare that with, you know, one person dying at the hands of a terrorist or one person getting into a location that would end up killing civilians? This is the Trump rationale. What do you say to that?
Well, one of the great things about Western civilization is that we don't start calculating the value of human life. We say that all human life is sacred, and we don't seek to compromise on that. What I would say is that the Cato Institute, which is not a liberal institute, it's a right-of-center think tank, has calculated that the chance of being killed by a refugee is 1 in 3.64 billion. In other words, you're four times as likely to be hit by lightning as you are to be killed by a refugee. And I think it's very important to recognize, as a humanitarian organization, we support effective security vetting. I have no hesitation in saying that. But I also have the confidence that comes from knowing that professionals of all political persuasions have said both that the existing vetting system is good, and secondly, that the reputational damage to the United States of this order is very strong. The former head of the CIA under President Bush, Michael Hayden, wrote a very powerful article in the Washington Post saying that this would make the job of assuring America's security more difficult. People who've been career CIA officials like him and who've risen to the top of the organization don't use words like that lightly. They are very concerned because reputational damage turns into real security risk. And that's the danger of this executive order.
Talking about that reputational damage, the Washington Post published a picture of one of the U.S. northern border crossings where it's seen that refugees in the United States are actually sneaking into Canada. What does that say?
I can only guess that these are people who are separated from their families in Iraq or in Somalia or in Syria and believe that by going to Canada, believe correctly, that if they go to Canada, then their family members will be able to join them. And it's worth pointing out, I think, the degree of sacrifice, not just that's involved in the refugees leaving their own countries. Some of the people who are effectively coming in under the refugee program are people who have served with the American forces in Iraq. What's interesting and what's deeply disturbing is that Iraqis who have served with the American military are now being allowed in under an exemption to the order. But Iraqis, many more in number, who worked with the U.S. government more generally, translators for an American ambassador rather than for an American general, they are not being allowed in. And there is no rhyme or reason to that. And I think that that is contributing to the sense of chaos and uncertainty that may be, in the cases that you cite, driving people to think that they've got a better chance of reuniting with their families in Canada.
How would this have changed your life if this had been in place and this precise kind of, order change had happened at the end of World War II?
Well, my parents were both refugees. Of course, Jews in Europe were not allowed into the United States in any kind of significant numbers until 1944. My dad was a schoolboy in Belgium in the 1930s and fled to England in 1940. My mom actually spent the war in Poland and only came to the UK in 1946. And so you're right, there is a personal link to this. And I think that we should have learned from our history. In 1941, Albert Einstein, who founded the International Rescue Committee 8 years before that, in 1941, Einstein wrote to Eleanor Roosevelt, begging her to ask her husband, Franklin Roosevelt, to allow Jews from Europe to come to the US. And tragically, the US policy of denying entry was not reversed until 1944, when in many ways the Holocaust had done its worst. And so I think there are lessons of history here about the role of civilized countries in coming to the aid of people in crisis. No one pretends that all the refugees are going to come here. Most refugees are in poor countries like Lebanon or Turkey or Kenya or Ethiopia. But for those who are the most vulnerable, it's right to provide haven, both for the substantive good it does and for the symbol that it represents.
With that sort of chilling image of a historical potential of damage having been done because of inaction. What damage do you see being done here once the court decisions are decided and we get back to a state of equilibrium?
Well, the greatest damage is that the reputation of America doesn't accord with the goodness of America. You must have had many politicians on your show who say that they believe in the power of the American example, not the example of American power. And this goes to that idea very, very centrally. There are people who want to help America around the world, but there are also extremists whispering in their ear that America will never have their back. And that's what's at stake. That's why all these former directors of the CIA, the former secretaries of state, the former national security advisors are all saying there is real material damage to our ability to be a force for good in the world and a force that's safe at home by this executive order. And it's not as if there isn't an easy way out. There is. The Trump administration can do their review of the vetting arrangements while leaving existing sound procedures in place. And that's why we say that hasty policymaking produces bad policy. There's no need for haste in this instance. And the sooner that firm ledge is stood on, the better.
David Miliband, International Rescue Committee president and a former British Foreign Secretary. Boy, these are times that you didn't expect to be dealing with in 2017.
That's absolutely right. But thank you for your interest. It really matters.
I can't wait.
First order of business is to keep our promise to repeal Obamacare and replace it.
Repeal Obamacare.
To repeal Obamacare.
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 That is why we are committed to rescuing people from this collapsing law and replace it with a much better system.
Obamacare doesn't work. So we are putting in a wonderful plan.
Haven't you heard? Repeal and replace on day one has now become...
I would like to say by the end of the year... at least the rudiments, but we should have something within the year and the following year.
That's President Trump speaking ahead of the Super Bowl on Sunday in an interview with Mr. No Spin Zone himself, Bill O'Reilly of Fox News. This is a real scramble for the GOP. It's the old rule, don't jump out of the plane unless you know you've got a parachute. It seems there still is no real plan for replacing the ACA. The confirmation of Tom Price as head of Health and Human Services may be the parachute, but that's a lot of pressure for a brand new cabinet secretary. Nevertheless, Republican Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming says Price can handle it.
People have been asking me when they're going to get to see the president's plan. And the president has said 1 week after Secretary Price is in office. But if you're curious about what the replacement will be, that would be a good thing to get done so that you can get a look at it.
Confirm Price, and you can get a look at it. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. The vote is looming. Is Mr. Price ready to be Mr. Replacement?
Dr. Price is on the Senate floor right now, John, and I remind you of that because he reminds everybody of it every chance he gets, and why not? His nomination is on the Senate floor right now with a vote scheduled possibly at 2 a.m. Friday morning, since they've backed up all these nominations behind Senate acrimony. We're not going to get a Obamacare replacement plan at 2:45 a.m. when Tom Price is confirmed. That's not going to happen. Why? John, if people are confused about what an ACA Obamacare replacement might look like, senators, congressmen, congresspersons are equally confused because right now I'm here to tell you there is no plan. And that's just the way it is because there's no consensus in Congress over what to do.
So what are people saying? I mean, do senators want to proceed on their own? Are there constituencies trying to back individual sort of initiatives? How's it going to go here?
Well, lots of different lawmakers have lots of different plans, and that's part of the problem. There's a legislative free-for-all going on right now where people are tossing all of their ideas into the pot, and that's normal for something as big as the U.S. healthcare system and something as politically volatile as healthcare. The question is, where are Republicans going to land now that they own the politics of 20 million people who, like it or hate it, have gotten insurance under Obamacare when you combine those exchanges and Medicaid? Let's talk about Susan Collins. She's from Maine. You've heard of her before. She's teamed up with a guy named Bill Cassidy. He's from Louisiana. He's also a doctor, by the way. And they have an idea that basically says, states, if you like your Obamacare, you can keep it. Here's Collins.
Ours is the only bill that has the unique combination of allowing states to choose to keep the Affordable Care Act. Another option would allow states to cover the uninsured population by providing a standard plan that had a high deductible, a basic pharmaceutical coverage, some preventive care. It would be financed through health savings accounts.
And this gets lots of support, or is she just speaking to the wall there?
Susan Collins is speaking to the bridge, trying to find a way to bridge people in California and New York, states that want to keep Obamacare because they think it's working, and a lot of other states where they think that it doesn't. Now, that option she's describing with basic pharmaceutical coverage, high deductible plans, is a very conservative Republican plan. You would expect a Republican to propose that. The question that looms over that is, what kind of coverage do you get? And even though the coverage is cheap, what does it really cover? How high is that deductible? Right. If you get sick, what does it cover? Is it really coverage at all, John?
There's a branding issue. Congressman Pete Sessions, he has an initiative called the World's Greatest Healthcare Plan. Catchy.
Yeah, that's Pete Sessions, the world's greatest. Also with Bill Cassidy, by the way. Dr. Bill Cassidy is all over a lot of these plans. Pete Sessions says if you like your Obamacare as an individual, you can keep it. If you don't like it, you can get off, and we will give you a refundable tax credit, which you get now under Obamacare to help pay for your insurance, and then you're pretty much on your own in the private market. That sounds like a lot of choice for people. The downside is it would weaken the insurance pools, and people who jumped out would raise costs right on everybody else. So that's part of the problem there.
Well, we're running out of time, but Paul Ryan warned about this, and you've covered this in the past. I'm wondering if there's anything about this that, you know, remember the old argument that the reason why Obamacare was so hated is that Obama rammed it through without any Republican consultation. Is that what this is? They're getting their chance to debate it, or is it something else?
They're getting their chance to debate it. They own the politics of this now. Paul Ryan says, don't worry, the House will have a replacement plan by the end of 2017. John, that's fine. That's the House. I want to leave you with this thought. Whatever Paul Ryan and the House Republicans produce, 60 votes in the Senate, and that means Democrats have to buy in. This nuking of the filibuster Supreme Court, that does not apply here. You got to get 60, and that means you need consensus. There is none right now.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
Divestment is the word in Washington State. The sound of protesters applauding the Seattle City Council, which decided in a unanimous vote to divest its investment activities with the Wells Fargo Bank, which handles about $3 billion a year for the city. Wells Fargo is lender to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Seattle has decided not to renew their contract after their current agreement ends in 2018, calling this a blow to the bank, as well as, quote, a blow to the billionaire class. This measure comes just as the Army Corps of Engineers told Congress that it will allow the $3.8 billion pipeline project to run under the Missouri River, just north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation, days after the Trump administration decided to restart the project altogether. Shama Sawant is a Seattle Socialist City Council member. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me, John.
What impact do you think this will have on the project? And do you think the wide-ranging protests that we saw last year are beginning again?
Actually, I do think that the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline are going to be resurging soon. And I think they're going to happen not only because of, as you said, you know, Trump reopening the Dakota Access Pipeline, saying the easement should be granted and everything should go on, but also these protests are going to happen in the context of the overall mood for fight back against Trump. Ordinary working people, young people, millennials, the 99%, are in no mood to negotiate with Trump, with his bigotry, with his billionaire-dominated cabinet. People really want to fight for a different kind of society. And it was in that spirit that I put the legislation forward in November for the city of Seattle to divest. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that by itself, Seattle's divestment is enough. But we hope that it will be a trendsetter around the nation.
If there were to be a challenge on the pipeline question and the plaintiffs would win, the tribes would win, it would mean lots more challenges on tribal treaty rights would happen, and the courts in Seattle would be the place where those disputes would take place, I suspect.
I think so, because the movement is very strong here. But I do believe that what we've done in Seattle has also been a morale booster for the movement on the ground at Standing Rock. I think that Seattle will be sort of a center for not only the judicial fights, but also the movements on the ground.
Any response from Wells Fargo to your decision?
Good question. Wells Fargo did issue a formal statement in which they said, we appreciate all different points of view, but we are legally and contractually obligated to carry through the Dakota Access Pipeline. And my response to that was, this is a corporation that in 2012 was indicted by the Department of Justice for, breaking the law by targeting subprime loans at African American and Latino households, even though they qualified for prime loans. Recently, just some months ago, I think in September, they were caught having created 2 million fraudulent accounts and, defrauding their own customers using their identities. And now suddenly they've grown a legal conscience? I don't think so. I think that this shows the fact that Wells Fargo is so unapologetic about this, and that it's not the only bank, but so many other banks are financing the Dakota Access Pipeline. It shows that our fight, the fight of the 99%, it's against climate change and towards renewable energy. But politically, the fight is against the oil lobby and the financial oligarchy that funds that oil lobby. And so this is, at this moment, somewhat of a David versus Goliath fight. But the victory that we've had in Seattle shows that the movement can prevail. The movement can force both the oil lobby and the politicians who implicitly or explicitly support the oil lobby to back down. But we need to keep building this movement.
Well, you don't sound much like David Kshamasawant, who's a city council member in Seattle. Very important conflict that is taking place. Shama, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, John.
Hey, who spilled the beans on the brand new head of the CIA?
Just FYI, I just got an alert from the official Turkish news agency saying that Mike Pompeo has arrived.
Why, Turkey, of course. Despite this being a supposedly secret mission, Mike Pompeo is in Turkey today. Borzu Dargahi is a Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News who says that the top-of-line agenda item is whether Turkey and the U.S. can see eye-to-eye on the Trump approach to fighting ISIS in Syria.
I think that there's a lot of issues that need to be discussed. Is there a possibility of rejuvenating or improving the relationship after it became rather frayed during the last years of the Obama administration? I'm sure that's on the agenda, but there's also sort of pressing, more acute issues that involve Syria and to a lesser extent, perhaps Iraq. But, Syria is the issue. Turkish troops and allied Syrian forces are fighting against ISIS in Al-Bab, in and around the city of Al-Bab, and they're badly bogged down. According to some accounts, the Turks are a little overwhelmed by this battle to take control of this ISIS-controlled city. And it was supposed to take weeks. It's now been months and months since the Turkish incursion into Syria. And, there seems to be no end in sight. And the Turks are looking for help with that regard.
Is the U.S. trying to get more assets on the ground? Are they reiterating where they're using bases from Turkey to operate inside of Syria?
I think that another issue is about Raqqa, the strategy for Raqqa. The Turks have been arguing strenuously under the Obama administration, as well as since Trump has been inaugurated, that the U.S. should not use the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces to take Raqqa. The Turks are very worried about how having this Kurdish-led force taking this Arab city will embolden their own Kurds in Turkey. And they do not like at all the particular Kurdish-led force that is leading this battle and that has been partnered with the U.S. Now, you heard a couple days ago that the U.S. administration has torn up the battle plan for Raqqa and left it in limbo a little bit. I'm sure that there is a little bit of coming here, talking to the Turks, see what they have in mind, if they have an interesting counterproposal as to how to take Raqqa. Because right now, There's no Turkish forces or Turkish-friendly forces anywhere near al-Raqqa. And I think that's going to be a big issue for the Turks and the U.S. is to figuring out how, if there's any kind of possible way of doing a battle for al-Raqqa that does not involve what Turkey considers a very much an adversary.
So would this involve actually a new basing in southeast Turkey? The CIA already has a base there, but would the U.S. and Turkish forces replace the Kurds in fighting al-Raqqa? That would be a serious escalation from the Turkish side of Syria.
Well, I think that the Turks have been pushing for that, and the Turks have been working with the Pentagon over the last few years in trying to train up a Syrian-led force to take on ISIS in both al-Raqqa and other parts of northern Syria. But those efforts went nowhere, and they were, you know, somewhat disastrous, according to some tellings. So, you know, they haven't had a lot of good luck doing that. I'm sure the Turks will push for that. I know that there was some sort of training underway, not necessarily at that alleged CIA base in Reyhanlı, but in other places scattered throughout Turkey, including in Sanli Urfa, the town of Sanli Urfa. But nothing has come of that yet. Meanwhile, you know, the Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, have a very, very effective, very, very emboldened force of men and women who are fighting against ISIS and have been fighting against ISIS and have fought effectively in ISIS. And they have this force pretty much surrounding Raqqa, at least in the outskirts. And they're just, you know, waiting for orders and air support to start the battle in earnest. So I think it's going to be a tough sell for the Turks to convince the U.S. to ditch this force that's already there and go with another strategy.
Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News, speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey. Thanks so much, Borzu.
It's been a pleasure.
A long time ago, a young man running for president said something about the American economy that sounded reasonable and even achievable. Restoring prosperity to the beleaguered regular American citizen.
I am tired of seeing the people who work hard and play by the rules get the shaft.
Well, the economy hasn't stopped shafting people. We learned that today, which a lot of people say explains the outcome of the 2016 election. But a new and very important book about this country's economy says that that idea wasn't even true when Bill Clinton said it back in the 1990s. The book is called Coming Up Short, Working Class Adulthood in an Age of Uncertainty. It tells stories of real people behind some alarming big data stats. For instance, last year a study by the Pew Research Center found that for the first time since 1880, young adults between the ages of 18 to 34 were more likely to be living with a parent than away from home. That's an alarming economic indicator, not a sign that young people would rather watch their parents' big screen TVs. Jennifer Silva worked for a decade on Coming Up Short, collecting stories of roughly 100 young working class adults from the towns of Lowell, Massachusetts, and Richmond, Virginia. Bill Clinton used to say, "I feel your pain," but what Silva discovered is that no one in the political system has felt these young people's pain. They are forgotten, they feel cheated, overwhelmed by realities that didn't fit what they were told in high school and college. They don't vote not because they are apathetic, but because they've given up on a system that's given up on them.
I have so many examples of young adults learning the hard way not to trust the social institutions that are supposed to work for them. So one example is a young man named Rob, who graduated from a vocational school with training to be a machinist, and he loved his work. But basically, the moment he graduates, he finds out that the skills that he learned in school are already obsolete. And he finds out basically that he'd need to have 5 years experience in order to work with his skills. For him, this is an example of an institution that he expected to prepare him, basically failing him. And I've seen so many of those. Basically, these young people feel that they are tricked by institutions that they counted on to help them. And in a sense, they're right. They don't have the knowledge and they don't have the skills they need to navigate them. And so in return, they give up on them.
And these are, you know, these are folks from all over the place having this very, very cynical attitude.
Yes, that's right. They're people who have jobs, service jobs. They go to community college. They try to raise families. In some ways, they are the children of the middle class of a generation ago who were very involved and very embedded in society.
Tell me about the sisters, Carly and Alyssa, who are trying to move forward in a very, very difficult situation and who you seem to have befriended in telling your story.
In that case, it was a story of, again, falling mobility, where the parents had high school educations but were able to buy a house. They were able to raise their family. But by the time their children had grown up, it was clear that they needed a college degree in order to maintain this sort of stable lifestyle. But they found that they had none of the information or knowledge or guidance they needed in order to go to college. And so Alyssa in particular, you know, tried to go to a regional college. She didn't understand how to fill out financial aid forms. She couldn't quite understand what to major in or how that major might translate into an actual job. And so she ended up feeling like there was no one there to guide her, and ended up leaving and dropping out, moving back home, working in a minimum wage service job, and really just feeling left behind.
And in this particular family, the echoes and the consequences of the financial crisis are still very much a part of their daily lives.
Oh, that's right. I mean, there's, you know, young adults in their late 20s who are unable to move out and who can't really imagine a future. They're just kind of waiting for their lives to begin.
Now, if you were defending and you probably have already done this, defending a dissertation in front of some, you know, hard sociologist types who want right. numbers and, you know, how many people does this represent? How significant of an economic phenomenon is this? How would you answer some of those tough questions?
Well, I'd say we hear a lot about the kind of top 1% versus the 99%. But really what I'd say is going on here is that, you know, the last few decades have seen the rise of maybe a 30% of upper middle class people who have jobs in technology and information. And then we have the kind of bottom 70% who are working in kind of semi-skilled jobs, who maybe used to be the blue-collar manufacturing middle class but can't really hold on to those jobs. And I think that the biggest divergence is that you have these upper middle class parents who, you know, now understand how competitive the economy is. They invest tons of time and tons of money into making their children competitive. And then you kind of have the other young adults, the ones that I'm interested in, who don't really have the public sources of guidance to help them figure out adult life. Their parents, because they didn't go to college, can't really guide them, and who are not learning the kinds of skills they need to be competitive in the economy.
What person was just really disserved by the expectations of this American dream, even the minimal requirements or minimal criteria of this American dream? Someone who, but for the grace of, just did not have a chance to get out of that 70%.
I think of one young man named Christopher, who, when I talked to him, he had been laid off. He didn't have a job. He'd been raised in foster care, so he didn't have parents he could count on. And when I was talking to him about his life, he told me, "I have this problem of being tricked." And so he kept having these experiences, like, you know, being taxed for not purchasing mandatory health insurance. You know, he couldn't seem to figure out the rules, and he felt like even answering the phone or opening himself up to people would lead to betrayal and would leave him worse off. And so the distrust and isolation that he learns is something that's really, really stayed with me.
I was riveted by this book. I was just illuminated by so many of the stories that you tell here, particularly after the election, where we're thinking about bubbles and who it is we don't encounter and who it is we do encounter. I mean, do you have any idea how important this book is, this research is?
I think there is this ethos of our young working class who, you know, they embrace self-sufficiency, they're choosing distrust and isolation, they're blaming other people who aren't successful. And I think if we don't understand that mindset, we cannot understand basically how to fix policy and how to kind of maybe help lift them up, but also how to understand politics.
Well, Jennifer Silva, forgive my hyperbole, but anyway, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Silva is assistant professor at Bucknell University and author of the book Coming Up Short. If you know anyone or relate to any of the stories Jennifer Silva just told us, we want to hear from you.
This is Candy from Delta Township. No, my mom was a single parent and worked in an auto parts factory in Detroit. I'm guessing I make at least quadruple what she did. I live a very different life than she did. I attribute that to my bachelor's degree, which is why I'm telling my children that they need to get a master's and preferably a lot more.
This is Ethan from Athens, Ohio. When my mom was my age, she was able to put herself through college and get a place to live on her own while making just over minimum wage. Nowadays, it would be impossible for me to do that. That's why I still live at home.
This is Arlene calling from Oakland. My parents were immigrants, and their parents believed in the value of education. My parents did well and pushed their children to do even better. I'm hoping my children will understand the importance of education and achieving their dreams as well.
This is Rolf from Fargo. No, I probably couldn't make ends meet on what my father did. My father was a steel worker. My mother was a homemaker. So probably no, I probably couldn't. Which is probably why I'm retraining, hopefully to be an interpreter for the U.N.
My name is Ryan, calling from East Lyme, Connecticut. I am 26 and make far more money than my parents. However, I could not survive off the same career as my parents had. Student debt is a killer. Go to the best school, not a state school, they said. That was serious hogwash, and they are still pushing that mentality in high schools. It is so sad.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to share your story. We want to hear your testimony. We might give you a call and invite you onto the program. Again, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. A story of waste and disillusionment. And just to top it off, you've got to hear this story about something similar that happened during the Obama years. In early 2008, around the same time that Jennifer Silva was talking to struggling young Americans, then-presidential candidate Barack Obama was jump-starting the engine of young people and tapping a grassroots political movement for change dedicated to restoring hope and prosperity, unlike anything seen in modern political history. A team of big thinkers, young techie geeks, and Silicon billionaires around the rising senator from Illinois were imagining this engine powering an off-road vision of activism for would-be candidates and workers for the first black president in U.S. history.
The key question is what happened after Obama won the election? And this is where everything, I think, you know, goes awry.
That's Mika Seyfried, a contributor to The New Republic and author of The Big Disconnect, Why the Internet Hasn't Transformed Politics Yet. Mika's investigation tells the story of how the Obama 500-horsepower Hummer of young activists was put up on blocks and left to rust, squandered in what he says is one of the most astounding missed opportunities in history.
It was important to have something ready the day after the election when people are on a high, at the moment of maximum enthusiasm, maximum sense that, you know, we can, as they said. And instead, nothing was ready. At this point, David Plouffe, who was the campaign manager, takes the reins of this question of what should we do with the movement. And he sends out an email to the 13 million people on Obama's list. I mean, this thing is really a juggernaut that no one has seen before. He sends this email out and he says, it's up to you to help us decide what you want this to be. And he gets back some amazing responses. I mean, the vast majority of people who write back absolutely want to keep supporting Obama. But most interesting to me, 50,000 of the people who reply say they're interested in running for local or state office. This mass number of people who have been so activated by the success and the experience and the training that they have in community organizing, they want to keep going. Instead, what happens is Plouffe and a lot of the senior campaign people get together in Chicago and they basically decide, of course, this is going to be controlled by the DNC. We're going to call it Organizing for America instead of Obama for America, but they keep the same platform, the same, you know, it's still the same list, and it's all going to just sit inside the DNC. And now that, John, is where you start getting emails asking to buy coffee mugs and sign thank you notes supporting congressmen who have, you know, endorsed the president's agenda, but they never used it as a tool to pressure Democrats who were being obstructionist or Republicans who were being obstructionist. They never used it as a tool to support local candidates who wanted to run. And as a result, early in the Obama administration, this giant grassroots muscle starts to atrophy.
What could this have done? How useful could this have been in 2010? as the Obamacare fight was happening and the Tea Party was showing up at these, you know, CNN events, wreaking havoc across the country. What might they have done?
Had the Obama grassroots really been continued in with the same kind of a momentum they had right after the election and in an independent form where they were, number one, they could have been doing a giant voter registration campaign. Number two, they could have been showing up locally, pushing for real healthcare reform precisely at the moment when the Tea Party was doing all the grassroots organizing, and there was very little of that by comparison from the Democrats.
And they could have been running for office and succeeding like Mike Pence did.
Right. The sad thing about the moment we're in now, if you're a Democrat, is that while Obama himself has been personally successful, he got reelected after all, very popular at the end of his presidency, the Democratic Party at its base has been hollowed out. The Democratic Party lost close to 1,000 seats in state legislatures. Local Democratic Party structures barely exist. And that's the thing that's now being revived as people are like basically realizing there's no one else here but us. But I view this as not just a sin of omission by Obama, but a sin of imagination that he allowed this whole thing to wither. You know, I think of it as an act of criminal political negligence.
And you say it leads to Trump.
And I think it leads to Trump.
What the heck happened?
So I think what happened is, first of all, Obama had to be president and he can't possibly pay attention to all of these details. He delegated it. He delegated it to people like David Plouffe, who had a different vision of what you could do with this grassroots army. And Plouffe basically thought of it as a media amplification device. We can use our 13 million people on our email list to help get our message out around the mainstream media. That's what he writes about in his book.
So he thinks of it as a bunch of clicks.
Exactly. And he even says, you know, when you're in the White House, you don't need to do organizing. You don't need to do fundraising. And so the whole thing becomes an arm of the Obama White House communications machine.
Do we know what Plouffe and Axelrod say about what you've written?
Well, here? Axelrod refused to comment, for the record, and Plouffe, I simply couldn't get him to respond. I have to say, Plouffe has done very well for himself. You know, after Obama won, he went on the speaking circuit. He sold a book. He made a couple million dollars. He then went back into the Obama White House to help rebuild the political operation that ultimately wins Obama the re-election in 2012. And more recently now, he's been hired by Mark Zuckerberg.
Meanwhile, the Republicans control both houses of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump is in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
The local Republican organizational structure in state and local assemblies, governorships, state houses, et cetera, is as strong as it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democratic Party and the DNC looks like a Roman ruin.
Right.
You're mad about this.
I am mad about it. I think this may have been the mistake that literally, you know, tears our history in two. But I do think there's a small silver lining. First of all, we can learn from these mistakes. And Democrats are in the process of having a debate about who should chair their party going forward. And this can be an issue in that question of, you know, what is the purpose of the Democratic Party and how should it be organized and how does it make sure that in all 50 states – it's trying to grow and make a difference, number one. And number two, something's going on in the country right now at the scale that we've not seen in a long time. And that's promising. It would be great if there were more of an infrastructure for it to flow into. It's pretty hard for people to build that infrastructure in the middle of these huge fights. But I'm a little bit of an eternal optimist. I think it's still possible that, you know, the resilience in our system is there for people to create the capacity that might have been 8 years ago the thing that could have made Obama a much more successful president, but that possibility is still there today.
Mika Seyfried, thanks so much. It's great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, John.
Mika Seyfried is a contributor to The New Republic and the co-founder and executive director of Civic Hall. So we've been asking you this hour, could you make it the way your parents did when they were your age?
Hi, my name is Mariah from Brooklyn.
Hi, I'm Amy from Ohio.
Stephen May, I'm calling from Kent, Ohio.
This is Rolf from Fargo. No,
I probably couldn't make ends meet.
Both of my parents have their graduate degrees. My mom paid for her own college education.
When I did enter college, I had a really hard time figuring out what I was supposed to do.
And I employ guys that come from a similar background to me and try to help them as much as possible. But boy, do they have the deck stacked against them.
Both of my parents in the early 1980s graduated and were able to get jobs straight out of college.
My father was a steel worker. My mother was a homemaker. So probably no, I probably couldn't. Which is probably why I'm retraining, hopefully to be an interpreter for the UN.
It's true that there is just nothing out there for us that can pay off our student debt and our student loans.
Weigh in with your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much, as always, for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.